I'm Gina Kaufman. Today on KCUR's Central Standard, we're exploring how and why the green bean casserole, that's right, the green bean casserole of Campbell's soup fame, became a Midwestern Thanksgiving staple, and how prepackaged foods became, well, traditional around here. I mean, we live in the agricultural heartland, but our annual harvest rich with foods that come from cans? Let's get the story from Dr. Lucy Long. She directs the Center for Food and Culture, and she's a professor at Bowling Green State University in Ohio. She's written a paper called Green Bean Casserole and Midwestern Identity, A Regional Foodway's Aesthetic and Ethos. Lucy Long, good morning.
Hello.
What gave you the idea to investigate green bean casserole as a symbol of Midwestern identity?
I know. Well, first of all, I am not from the Midwest. I'm from the South, from North Carolina. And I lived on the East Coast before moving out to Ohio. And so when I moved out here, I noticed a lot of differences in the food. And one of the definitions of regional cultures, regional identity, is that it is culture that contrasts according to place. So as soon as I went to a salad bar in Ohio and met up with Jell-O salad and basically mayonnaise-based concoctions of
this
things.
This is so funny. That, yeah. Those are exactly the items I would name also, but go on.
Okay, yeah. So I started noticing that green bean casserole had a special place in the hearts and menus of people out here. When I was doing a lot of research on Thanksgiving meals and family dinners and holidays, and I would ask my students to bring in the menu of what they had had for Thanksgiving dinner. And the students would invariably say, we just have all the usual normal American stuff. Turkey, mashed potatoes, stuffing, white bread stuffing, green bean casserole. I say, green bean casserole? I say, yeah, of course. And say, well, no, I mean, this is not considered normal in other places. And they all insisted it had to be at every Thanksgiving meal. It also is frequently found at church potlucks and just kind of regular everyday evening family meals. So I thought something is going on here. Initially, when I would talk about this to people outside the region, if they were from the Midwest, they would all nod and smile. So I knew I was onto something. This was a dish that was meaningful to people in the Midwest. Other people would actually say things like, are you serious? Do they really eat that? You know, are they just lazy, or they're incredibly ignorant about cooking and taste? You know, why on earth would anybody eat this?
You know, it's funny, your story, I mean, I have had a similar kind of experience. My family's from Chicago, which is technically Midwestern, but it's urban Midwestern, and I had seriously never heard of the whole green bean casserole phenomenon until I was in my 20s. I worked at a homestyle restaurant where we made green bean casserole every Tuesday for dinner, and I was really surprised when the customers treated it like the most nostalgic comfort food in the entire world and talked about, like, of course we all grew up eating this stuff. It made me feel like an outsider in my own city, I think, just by having a different kind of lineage.
Right. Well, part of the irony here is green bean casserole seems to be a family tradition among mostly rural families. So the irony that these are rural families who are farming, and yet here this family food tradition is made out of processed ingredients commercially available that are distributed all over the U.S., and the recipe itself was invented in 1955 in the Campbell Soup Test Kitchen in Camden, New Jersey. So
Yeah. Listeners
it
to Morning Edition may have already heard Peggy Lowe's story on this already, but in case we've got folks who missed it, can you tell us the story of green bean casserole, where it came from, and what was going on in the culture at the time?
Yes, it was invented in 1955 in Camden, New Jersey, in the test kitchen of Campbell Soup. And it was presented in 1955 as this is a is both traditional, but it's also very modern. And the Campbell Soup Company, first of all, was it was a it started as a family-run business. I think it was two brothers on the East Coast. And it always had this aura of family food, family tradition. So Campbell Soup itself had that whole just kind of identity. And then in the 1950s, keep in mind that after World War II, the entire nation just wanted to go home and have a simple plain life. They didn't want to have any surprises. And people were very much into being American and celebrating national unity. So people did not want to do things like celebrate different ethnic identities or regional traditions. They wanted things that everybody in the U.S. could participate in and were participating in.
Really
So,
uniformly.
yes. So, and that's part of the reason it was so easy for companies, for food corporations to then step in and provide this. So that people wanted to be able to buy the same foods everywhere they went.
But what about this whole thing you were talking about? What is the explanation for why in these like food producing regions in particular, food producing communities of all places, would a tradition that is based on something that you take out of a can, why would that take hold particularly there?
Right, I know. And that was definitely the question that I had too. I knew that it was not a matter of poor taste or laziness or lack of culinary skills. So what I did was I started looking into what I refer to as the culinary ethos and aesthetics of this particular region. And by ethos, I mean belief systems, value systems. And if we look at this particular area of Northwest Ohio, this used to be a swamp. And people started settling in the early 1800s. It was very, very hard work. They had to drain the fields, cut down all the oak forest. If you let up at all, nature came back in and reclaimed the land. So there was this ethos of we have to tame nature in order to survive. Nature is not our friend. That then carried over without people actually thinking about it. It carries over into the approach to food. People would rather have food that has been somehow processed and factory made because then they can count on it. They know it's going to be there. If you count on nature, you never know what's going to
And that could apply
happen.
in Kansas and Missouri too. I mean, in Kansas, there you have seasons of drought. You have all sorts of struggle trying to raise food in this area, even though that is predominantly what was happening here.
Yes.
You made this statement about the Midwestern ethos. I wonder what are the other things that would characterize the Midwestern food ethos. I mean, what makes a food Midwestern?
Well, several things. Although I do want to say that to say the Midwest, we're talking about a vast area, and there is a lot of diversity in the Midwest also. But The Midwest was settled by pioneers. It was people who were coming out and trying to establish farms, establish livelihoods that generally had to rely on a lot of hard work, and they had to rely on themselves as well as their immediate communities. They didn't have time to sit around and think about what they were doing. Their approach to food and to life in general, things had to be functional in order to be of value. So food had to be functional. It had to be filling and at least nutritious enough to to keep people surviving. It had to be hearty and filling. And it had to be guaranteed to be tasty in the way that people were expecting it to be.
When you say expecting, do you mean that there's a certain requirement of predictability?
Yes. Which is also an all-American kind of ethos and aesthetic. You know, we expect uniformity so that if we put our money on something, we are going to get exactly what we are paying for.
Are there, you talked about in the 1950s that it was easy for corporations to get their foods out there, partly because of this desire for people to be doing things, for there to be recipes that everyone has access to, traditions that everyone is participating in with some uniformity and predictability. Are there other Midwestern classics from this era that incorporate prepackaged foods as crucial ingredients?
Well, some of the things that, you know, that people kind of laugh about would be Jell-O.
Yeah, like the Jell-O salads with things floating in them.
Yes, yes, and you know that actually is a tradition that is more widespread than just the Midwest, but it does seem to be very, 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 very distinctive in a way, or representative. When you go to a salad bar in the Midwest, in the rural Midwest, and they almost always have lots and lots of different types of Jell-O salads. You can find that in other places also, and it's almost now become more of a class characteristic rather than just a regional characteristic, but it is something that is very, very prevalent here.
And mayonnaise, it seems to me anyway, plays a special role in Midwestern food.
Yes. Yes, it's used as an ingredient in cakes. It's also a lot of salads are very strongly mayonnaise-based. And it tends to be commercially made mayonnaise, which is one of the things that distinguishes it from Southern traditions, which also uses a lot of mayonnaise. But good Southern cooks tend to make their own mayonnaise, or traditionally.
So listeners, I wonder how you would define Midwestern food, and what is the classic example of it in your mind? 816-235-2888 is the number to call. That's 816-235-2888. And Lucy, how have Midwestern Thanksgivings changed over time?
Well, you know, I think they've changed in the same ways that that Thanksgiving dinners have changed everywhere, and that the American palate has been expanding in the last 10, 20 years. So people are experimenting with things a little bit more. Taste in the Midwest do tend to be fairly conservative, and people kind of pride themselves on not having new things.
I have a question about that. I mean, it seems this is just a non-expert sort of casual observation, but it seems like there is maybe a little less regionalism in food than there used to be, even though eating local is such a pride and joy. I think part of what's going on is that people have access to so much information about what other people in other places are eating, and that there's kind of become this culture of every home cook is trying to be a chef on some level. And that seems to apply to Midwestern home cooks as well.
Yes. There also is a trend, especially starting after 9/11, Americans started looking inwards rather than outwards for resources, for new expression. And people started paying attention to regional cuisines. So it started becoming very common for people to look specifically for something that could be, that could represent a region. There were a lot more cookbooks coming out on regions. A lot of companies were now producing things. You know, there would be Virginia style this, Kansas style this, or whatever. So so there actually did start being more recognition of regional diversity. That's partly because people are always looking for something a little bit novel. It for marketing purposes, and also if they have an exploratory nature, they're looking for something, something new and different. And Americans tended to be looking towards themselves rather than to other countries. The international food has since become of huge interest to the food industry and to cooks.
Let's go ahead and bring Judith Fertig in on this conversation. She's a local novelist, cookbook author, and self-proclaimed foodista. Hi, Judith. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks, Gina. Great to be here.
Great to have you. What would you say about how the Midwestern Thanksgiving meal has evolved? What used to be on the menu that's conspicuously absent these days, and what's new on the table?
I think if you go back to the novels of Laura Ingalls Wilder, who was from Missouri and lived all, different places throughout the Midwest. I loved those books as a kid, and you can read about the traditional Thanksgiving dinner that we still eat today, and that is turkey with gravy, mashed potatoes, yeast rolls. Back then, they didn't get their foods from a can. It would have been home canned vegetables. But I think, that same dinner we're eating in variations today. My family, however, doesn't do that. We are, our tradition is that we always do something different. So
From year to year.
So
your tradition is to not have a tradition.
Yes. So we like to change it up because we all like to cook, and everybody brings a dish, and that's the fun of it.
Well, this conversation started with casserole. So talk to me about casserole in general. I mean, what do we need to understand about the casserole from the home cook's perspective?
Well, a casserole has a lot going for it. Number one, it's a very comforting dish. It's usually softer in texture. You can make it ahead, which is great for Thanksgiving. You can in Kansas City, where people have an outdoor kitchen, you could warm it up on the grill if you wanted to. You could use your indoor oven, and there are lots of different ways to do a casserole that you don't have to do it with, with canned ingredients. You can use fresh ingredients, and you can make your own portobello mushroom white sauce if you want to. So I think those are things that people still like.
Do you do casseroles?
I am probably going to do a casserole this year for Thanksgiving. It'll be more of a kind of an herb and fruit bread pudding sort of casserole. There's one I want to try from the chef in Kinston, North Carolina. It's a kind of a yellow squash casserole. So the chef and the farmer.
This conversation about Thanksgiving and classic Midwestern recipes will return in just a minute. Call 816-235-2888 to tell us about the qualities that make food seem inherently Midwestern. You can nominate the ultimate Midwestern dish while you're at it. 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman. KCUR Central Standard will return.
From the valley of the jolly,
ho, ho, ho,
green giant, good things from the garden, garden in the valley, valley of the jolly green giant.
We We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman, and my guests on KCUR's Central Standard are Judith Fertig and Lucy Long. Judith is a local cookbook author, and Lucy is a folklorist who runs the Center for Food and Culture. She's written a paper called Green Bean Casserole and Midwestern Identity, a Regional Foodway's Aesthetic and Ethos. Hi again, Judith.
Hi, Gina.
And welcome back, Lucy.
Hi. Hi.
We've been hearing theories on what makes a meal Midwestern, and I want to explore a little bit more whether that's changing today. Judith, what are your thoughts on that?
On green bean casserole?
On what makes a meal Midwestern and whether that's changing today.
I think what makes it Midwestern is that we look for the best of whatever is in our area, no matter where you happen to live. And in Kansas City, that would be, you know, we're lucky enough to have flour that is milled from wheat that's grown in our area. We have local wines. We have local beer. We have farmers market vegetables. One year, I did a Thanksgiving and everything except the coffee was from Kansas. So that was really fun. And it really, if Thanksgiving is about celebrating abundance and being thankful for what you have, I think you can look to your own area and your own region and what grows best and what tastes best and have a wonderful meal.
So Midwestern ingredients make a Midwestern meal.
Yes. Yes.
What are you seeing more of that kind of attitude yourself, Lucy?
Well, now, you know, I would actually have to disagree with Judith on that. And it shows the diversity that is in the Midwest. When I moved to Northwest Ohio, I was very excited about moving to an agricultural area. I thought, oh, good, I'll have a lot of fresh vegetables and fresh food. Well, it's a heavily industrial agriculture region. If I wanted to eat locally, it would have been soybeans and field corn, as well as tomatoes that were being grown specifically for factories. So I would say that the concern now with what's fresh and local, that's part of a very recent trend.
And maybe like a niche thing?
Well, it's an international trend to try to eat local for ethical as well as aesthetic reasons. People in the Midwest frequently did have their own kitchen garden, and they did raise a lot of their own vegetables. If someone did not have a home garden, they frequently, and even now, the small town that I live in, you know, we don't have a farmer's market year round.
In Ohio.
Yes. Yeah, and it's very different. You know, rural areas are very, very different from urban areas. So I wouldn't say being fresh and actually the idea of it being the best, in some ways that's the antithesis of what I see as Midwestern, because most of the Midwestern food is intended to be eaten by everybody.
So there's are you saying there's like a modesty or humility in it? Is that what you're talking about?
Yes, yes. There is, there's an attempt to make food that everybody will like. And if you make something that is too expensive or a little different, you know, seen as hoity-toity, you're setting yourself apart. And there are plenty of people who are cooking with fresh and excellent ingredients. You know, but in general, I'd say the regional aesthetic is more that the food is meant to be functional, but also shared by everybody. It's supposed to be accessible to everybody.
Let's hear.
It's friendly.
Let's see what Judith has to say about this.
I think, you know, when we think of Midwestern food, it kind of goes back to the farm dinner. And the farm dinner was, you know, from what you had, you know, a fried chicken, or it would have been beef. And I think that's still kind of the heart of Midwestern food. But it was also what you did well. If the farmer's wife had a garden, it was pickled beets, or it was home canned jellies and jams. You know, you go back to the novels of Willa Cather, and they celebrate the beautiful jewel colored preserves that people had, and people are newly interested in that. Lucy is exactly right. If you are in a farming area where the farm is like a factory on the land, and you're going to eat soybeans and field corn, and then that's not good. And that's the same kind of area where people would get their recipes either from the newspaper, if it was a larger newspaper, or from the back of a box or the back of a can. But that certainly doesn't speak to the Midwest.
Let's go ahead and hear from some callers on this idea of what makes foods Midwestern. First, we've got Rob in Leavenworth. He's called 816-235-2888. Hi, Rob.
Hello.
Hi. What's your nomination?
Well, I can't imagine a conversation about Thanksgiving in the Midwest without wild game. I mean, that's what people, I mean, Laura Ingalls Wilder, that you were talking about earlier, that's what we all grew up on. You know, have a deer roast or of all things, have a wild turkey for Thanksgiving. I mean, there are more wild turkeys today than there ever were in the pioneer times.
Do you hunt your own turkey?
Absolutely.
Well, where did you get your, have you already hunted your Thanksgiving turkey?
I do. I have maybe more than one Thanksgiving turkey in the freezer as we speak.
Rob, what does it mean to you to hunt wild game as part of your Thanksgiving tradition, and furthermore, just as part of your Midwestern culinary tradition?
Oh, it's part of self-reliance. It's part of enjoying the traditions of the Midwest. It's gorgeous when you get off the interstate and you walk the hills, particularly around the area of all over the state, both Kansas and Missouri.
Well, thanks so much for that call, Rob. You know, Lucy, I wonder if this is something that also appears in your research when you think about Midwestern food.
Yes, the notion of self-reliance is definitely part of the ethos and aesthetic there. And then also, I mean, it's interesting that he mentions wild game, but he's talking about big things. And part of the idea of the Thanksgiving dinner, it's a formula for a meal, and you have to have something big. The turkey is traditionally the big central thing. You know, and that's representing abundance, generosity. It means you can have lots of people sit down at the table. It's meat also, which is pretty important and very symbolic. But part of what makes the meal work is individuals can put their own meanings into this formula by the ways in which they are obtaining that meat, you know, or the variations they might put on the marinade. They can make it Italian style. They can make Thai marinade. You know, they can put their own identity into this in some way, either by the way they're getting the turkey, you know, or they use an alternative meat that's meaningful to them, or they prepare it in a way that's meaningful to them.
Judith, as someone who has a Thanksgiving tradition of not doing things the same way every year, I wonder if you do still follow that basic formula of there's one big central thing, generally a meat, and then this sort of constellation of side dishes.
Yes, that's exactly what we do. I actually wrote a Thanksgiving story for Vegetarian Times one year, and they used that same formula. So what is the showstopper main thing that is not meat? So I think, you know, that's a good pattern for a Thanksgiving meal. You have the showstopper entree, you have all the satellite side dishes, you have not one but maybe two desserts, and all the rest of it. And it's even even better if people have contributed in some way. If people bring a dish, if people make what is meaningful to them, I think it's a great way to do a Thanksgiving dinner.
Let's talk to Janie in Prairie Village. Janie, what can you share?
Hello. I just wanted to mention I am old enough to remember, vaguely. At any rate, I predate the green bean casserole. And I well remember that this time of year, fresh vegetables were not available in this part of the country. So this kind of, I'm sorry, but a little bit of how weird to use processed foods is a little off target. We didn't have fresh green beans, or broccoli was unheard of. Cauliflower was available, which is why I think it's popular. Squash and corn was canned at this point.
So it's partly like access to some of these things in another way would have been impossible.
Absolutely. So dressing up the green beans with mushroom soup and canned onion rings made them quite special.
Well, Janie, thanks so much for that call. That really does add some insight. It's great to hear from you.
Yeah, I think it's something that maybe was missed, but I do remember, and even Brussels sprouts could only be canned, and nobody likes canned Brussels sprouts.
I think you might be right about that, Janie. It's probably not a coincidence that those have become more popular of late, now that you can get them fresher. What do you think about that, Lucy?
Well, I'm actually very, very glad that she brought that up. When I talk about green bean casserole being consistent with a traditional Midwestern aesthetic, part of what I say there is that home canning was a tradition, not just in the Midwest, you know, but it was very prevalent here. And the move from home canning to factory canning meant that it was the same kind of taste. And the caller is absolutely correct. I mean, you could not get fresh green beans, after the harvest. You could dry them maybe, but, you know, canning tended to be the way to keep them. You know, so there is a taste for canned food that is part of what I would say kind of the Midwestern aesthetic.
Let's talk to Rebecca in Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi, Gina.
What can you share?
I have recently moved down here to Kansas City. I'm originally from Minnesota, and I wanted to bring up a good point that Judith made a few minutes ago about utilizing the local food. Growing up, our Thanksgiving was really kind of, we wanted to use what we thought that the original first Thanksgiving would have been like. So we used, we would go get wild rice, and we would go to our local co-op and do that. And then we discovered green bean casserole. My mom didn't grow up with it, so I think we were just kind of shopping, prepping for Thanksgiving, and then we just kind of stumbled upon the French's green onion, or the French's fried onions, and we tried that, and it's good. so I don't know. It's kind of, and we've tried doing different variations, finding organic low sodium cream of mushroom soup, or trying to frozen green beans, and we always kind of just go back to what they say on the recipe, the Campbell's cream of mushroom. And the I think just Campbell's or French's
onions.
Beans.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the French's onions too. So, but yeah.
Well, thanks, Rebecca. Thank you so much for that call. You know, I've been working on a recipe for from scratch green bean casserole that we'll have on our website later this week. But there is, I mean, maybe there is something to be said for it's a classic for a reason. I do wonder, when we think about Midwestern food, what about the changing demographics of the Midwest? I mean, when we say Midwestern food, do we include the food traditions of all the diverse people who now live in our region? Or are we still talking essentially about the foods of white rural people, essentially like headed mm-hmm. to a neighborhood church potluck? Judith?
Well, I think, if we look at Kansas, there were 60 different immigrant groups who settled in Kansas, and they were from all parts of Western Europe. You know, you had freed slaves that came. And so it was really and truly a melting pot. And, you know, those signature foods turn up in festivals throughout the year, whether it's kolaches or buraks or all of those things. And sometimes those make their way to the Thanksgiving table. I know Italian families like to do the red gravy, and they like to have lasagna or some kind of pasta dish along with the turkey. So I think those things do pop up, and your ethnic origin. So I think give it a couple years. It's usually like a generation or two, and maybe we'll have Hmong or Ethiopian, or you just never know.
What do you think about this, Lucy? I mean, what do you think about what we do and don't include when we talk about quote unquote Midwestern food?
Right. It's a very loaded question. And it is something that I think we actually need to take very seriously, because who gets to define what is Midwestern food? You know, we have all sorts of questions of power that come into play here. You know, part of what I have tried to do is go out and talk to as many people as possible who come from as many different backgrounds as possible. And I ask them, what do you think of as Midwestern food? I ask them, what do you think is American food? You know, which is also a loaded question. So, you know, so part of what we're dealing with are actual patterns. You know, a certain number of people do use these particular ingredients, as well as perceptions. And the perceptions are created partly by the patterns, partly by what people are experiencing. They're also created by marketing and advertising. The food industry has created all sorts of definitions of regional cultures, food cultures,
yeah.
You know, that sometimes don't even exist. But so it's a very, very loaded question and very important.
If I wanted, just before we go, to start a new culinary trend that would take off and be eaten by millions of families every Thanksgiving for years to come, like the green bean casserole, Lucy, what would be your advice to me? Can I learn from this model?
Yes. Some of the current trends, the whole locavore food movement, where people trying to eat locally. And that's partly for taste. Food tastes better when it's fresh and season, eating seasonally. But also there's a move towards finding foods that are indigenous to an area.
Judith Fertig, thanks so much for being here
today.
More
sustainably.
Yeah, thank you. And thank you, Lucy Long. It's been a real pleasure.
Sure, thank you.
Thank you, Gina.
You can check out Peggy Lowe's story about the green bean casserole at kcur.org. When KCUR's Central Standard returns, what it means that the 160,000 square foot Westport Middle School building is transforming into a huge co-working studio.